Well, g'day, folks. We're back. It's episode 3, I believe, Shilty. Am I right?
That is correct, mate.
Episode 3. It's two very ordinary coppers. Mm. Or two ordinary cops, I think we're calling ourselves.
Oh, very ordinary.
Very. Yeah. So we're back again. Look, on the last episode, we sort of touched on those first days when you first come out of the college and everything's new and shiny and scary and you sort of can't believe that you're the ones in the uniform and that people where in the days before you join the job, you may call the police if there's a problem. Well, all of a sudden people are calling you and they call you a lot.
Yeah.
So we sort of touched on
Let's just touch on that for a bit there, Damo. Sorry, I do butt in on you there. But, mate, like, Catherine was a busy station. I know you've worked some really busy
stations.
Is a busy station. Now, what I like how she get out of the viewers, there's over 100 cops in Catherine.
Yeah.
And they work 24 hours a day.
Yep.
And it's non-stop. And, look, just, like, if we get a bit of insight about what a night shift's like.
Yeah, well, the night shifts, what we're going to do is going to roll into that more experienced. So once you start to do this for a while and you sort of get very used to what you're doing and the comfort zone factor kicks in. And what we're going to touch on in a minute is all of a sudden you hit a critical incident.
Yep.
And that's where you realise you're still new.
Yep.
So a night shift in Catherine, and like I think I touched on in the last episode, if day shift have done their job and clamped down on the social order and taken away that alcohol and removed the problematic people around the place, then generally speaking, night shift will be less impactful.
Yep.
If for whatever reason that hasn't occurred and the alcohol's flowed hard, well,
which can happen sometimes.
It can happen. For whatever reason, it can happen and it does snowball. Then the typical night was generally busy. You turn up at 7 o'clock at night and you might have an idea of what you're going to do.
Yep.
But the truth of the matter is that 000 and the radio dictate to what. And I think this will resonate with anyone who's listening who's in the job. That you might have a plan for what you want to do at night and that plan will go completely out the window.
Definitely.
So, examples are a busy night in Catherine general duties, and you must forgive me, any of the current serving Catherine members, because I haven't worked there in a very long time. But generally speaking, you were still dealing with your social order stuff early on. You still had the drunkenness carrying on. You had the people arguing. You might get called to the BP for someone shoplifting, is drunk at the front, won't leave, whatever. But then as the night goes on, you start to get your domestics. And they can vary. You'll turn up and it'll be the old Catherine two-step was aggravated assault, breach, DVO.
Yep.
And that was the staple. You're forever, you turn up to something and it's a partners.
It's your bread and butter.
Each other. And that's it. So you do a lot of that kind of work. So a lot of it, unfortunately, is domestic violence related, alcohol-fueled, and quite often in bad places. You go into a house, it's not a nice house. It's a very, very smelly, very unsanitary.
Yep.
There's lots of people. There's lots of alcohol. Unfortunately, there are children around. They're not good places. So you're dealing with that. But the trouble is you're dealing with a lot of that very early on.
Yeah.
And you get used to that and you start to get good at it. And you start to understand how you're doing your job and you know what your job is. And so you get through that night shift where you might have gone to two or three jobs. You might have arrested an offender who's too intoxicated to deal with at the time. So there's a provision within the law in the NT that allows you to hold a person on what we call investigatory detention. That person can stay there overnight in order to sober up and then to partake in an interview or to be charged or whatever else.
Yep.
So quite often you do that, and while that person's in custody, they're waiting anyway. They're in tox. They're not going to sober up through the night, so you're back into the jobs.
Yep.
So it might get to the point where there's a number of people in custody for similar sort of offending.
How many do you reckon is your highest you've had in the morning, sitting in the cells waiting?
Sitting that we try and deal with as many as we can, but then hand over quite a few. I think, I would hate to say, I don't know exactly, but it would be 4 or 5. It's not a small number. And we're talking about a town that's not very big.
And when you say 4 or 5, like, you're basically talking hours of paperwork. And, like, hours. Interviews and all that sort of stuff. It's not like, yeah, 4 people, they're in and out.
Absolutely not. So you've got to remember that in order to charge somebody, you need to have what in legal terms they call a prima facie case. So that means you've got it's a Latin term meaning that on the face of it, it looks like an offence has been committed.
Yep.
So obviously we're going through that and we're getting the evidence together. So that's statements. That all takes time. The paperwork side of things is quite onerous. And that was... a lot of what you do is, as a police officer, is that it's compiling the prosecution files, carrying out the role that you have to do in regard to general orders and standard operating procedures, things like that. So you're dealing with that through the middle of the night. And the beauty about night shift, or the not the beauty about night shift, is that it's bloody night shift. So you're
and these
trying,
are 12-hour shifts.
12-hour shifts they were, yeah, back then. They're not anymore.
No.
The old seven to seven. Yeah, two nights, 2 days. I love them.
Yeah.
They were a bit controversial. Not everyone loved them, but I certainly did.
Yeah, so I did
and I
too.
Think a lot of people in our era did.
Definitely.
So anyway, you come 2, 3 in the morning. I think the reason being, if you do 2 days, you're either at work or you're not.
Yeah, that's right.
You get a chunk of days off, and I think a lot of us like that. You go to work, you do your job,
yep.
You do it long and hard, and then you stop, and you don't have to worry about it again.
And the thing is, sometimes you used to do 16 hours because you got overtime and all that sort of thing, and it wasn't such a bad thing, because the thing is, you do 2 days, 2 nights, 7 to 7, and then you get 4 days off.
Yeah.
And then every roster period, you'd end up with 6 days off when the roster changed, or somewhere in that process. So, like, you could almost have a week off.
Yep.
Every
without
6 weeks.
Taking leave.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the old roster system was good.
Mm.
The thing is, you're still doing a night shift. So, on those 2 nights, especially the first night, and look, I've actually worked in other rosters around the place, and not that it's not relevant to Catherine in those early days, but I've done things called quick changes, which are still done and still would be common in a lot of jurisdictions, where basically you carry out a 7 to 3, knock off at 3 o'clock, come back at 11 o'clock.
Yep.
They used to kill me. Absolutely kill me. And I don't know anyone who could really do them and say that they felt amazing and on top of the world and able to conquer the entire universe at 3 a.m. on a quick change.
Mate, I'm sorry, I'm just going to cut in there. I'm going to throw in a red herring. What's your longest shift?
Well, this is a good point. We can get to that in the remote stuff. The longest ever shift was in a community called La Jamanu, which is on the northern edge of the Walpri area down on the Tanami Desert. And it was during a sports weekend, and there were other communities in the area. And we worked out with maybe 20 minutes of a head on a pillow in the middle, 43 hours. 43 hours straight. So that's the longest shift.
Well, you beat me, mate. Mine's 38.
38, there we go. Got you by 5. So going back to the night shift side of things, you're dealing with this stuff in the middle of the night, and because your brain's not working at its full function, mistakes happen. Mistakes happen with paperwork, and poor old day shift turns up and has to deal with that.
Mistakes happen?
Mistakes happen. You wouldn't believe it. Police are human.
Yeah.
So you've got that. You're dealing with that. You're dealing with the fatigue and just the sheer busyness. And things do generally quieten down come 2, 3 in the morning. Not that you ever use that word, and that's quite a universal.
Yep.
It's universal within police, and I know that AMBOs are the same.
You don't say quiet, mate. The Q word is definitely...
No, it'll get you a dressing it down. Will. So, what we'll move on to is the early stages of the career where you've moved past that initial fear factor. So,
yep.
You've gone beyond where everything's new and shiny. You've started to settle in. You're getting comfortable in your role. You're starting to feel like you're part of the team. Because another thing I didn't mention was, in those early days, you feel like if I just went home, these guys would actually be more efficient. They're doing a lot of what they're doing. Is propping me up and trying to teach me stuff. And they're busy. The poor buggers, they're only junior police themselves, but they're trying to teach me, and I'm an imbuggerance.
Yeah.
So you move beyond that. You start to feel like, well, actually, no, I'm part of this team. I'm good. I'm starting to carry my weight a little bit.
Yep.
Something that we did quite a bit of early on, Chilty, was relief. So when I say relief, I mean remote service relief. So not the
we might just
leave that alone. But yeah. So we did remote service relief. So the permanent members in remote areas would go on leave, and somebody from the major centre that controls that area would go and relieve them. And this is fantastic because you go from Catherine or Alice or Tennant Creek, being or Palmerston as well relieved. So those areas are very busy and they're very impersonal. You do your thing, you turn up to work, away you go. All of a sudden, you move out to the communities, and the speed of work slows.
Mm.
So you're not turning up on shift and just going job to job to job and getting smashed and then having days off and you're just another person in the crowd.
Mm.
You are the police.
Mm.
In those communities, everyone knows you 24/7, you are them. But it's good because you get to engage with the community, and you certainly, especially early on, you learn that other side of policing.
Definitely, and communication skills, because you have to use your communication out there. It's not like you can call backup.
No, backup's 100 k's away. They're going to turn up to two bodies on the ground.
And that's only two people.
Yeah.
The rest of them are 500 k's away.
Exactly. And they're busy. They've got to put a team together.
Mm.
If you've got a major incident where you need tactical police, being the Territory Response Group up in the Northern Territory, well, they're based out of Darwin. There's a call out. There's a plane ride. They'll come, but it's going to take a while.
Exactly.
So we did that early on. So you're getting established. You're starting to go, right, I'm in this job. I've worked in the communities now. I've seen how things go. I've seen the different styles. And then you get a critical incident. And I mean, you would have seen some stuff. You probably haven't seen a dead body yet, but you definitely would have seen some pretty bad injuries.
Yep.
You felt the adrenaline. You've made some violent arrests. You've had to use force. You've slapped the handcuffs on. You've done all that. And you're starting to get good at what you do. All of a sudden, it's 8 a.m. and the radio kicks off. 481 VKM urgent. Please attend. Motor vehicle crash northbound. So you're heading north out of town, out of Katherine, and you turn up to
this job.
Yeah, to a. Now this is my first fatal.
No, I didn't attend. Just to let you know.
That's okay.
But I did actually have a very we had a debrief about.
We did. You've got to remember as well, all the police, and I think it's Australia wide, and certainly Australia wide, and I would think in most first world countries around the world, are senior first aid plus trained.
Mm.
And when I say plus, I mean that we used to. I'm not sure if they still do it, but we would do a. First responders style as well. So not just senior first aid, it's a little bit more, and it's also graphic. They'll show you a graphic injury detail that they wouldn't show standard civilian senior first aid courses.
Because they did actually change that over the... And we actually improved on our... St. John's actually said that our police training improved in a way because we had a couple of medics join the police and they actually rewrote how we did our first aid. Forward.
They did too. I remember that. So you've always putting first aid into a little bit of practice, but not necessarily all the time, because the ambos are pretty close, and if it's a critical incident, you might hold a bandage on someone, on an injury or something, but the ambos will turn up and take over, and you basically protect the ambos. So when you're first on scene, we attended a motor vehicle crash, and the person, and just out of respect to the family, I'm not going to identify the timings or who was involved, but the person was outside the vehicle, and very obviously badly injured, but I mean not obviously deceased.
Mm.
So of course you just roll into the old doctor's ABC. So you're checking for that. There was a truck driver at the time who'd called in the crash, and he'd tried to do some CPR on this lady, but I did the head tilt, and as I put my hand on her head, I could tell straight away that she had a catastrophic skull fracture. There was I could feel the bones moving in my left hand. So straight away, I didn't think there was much likelihood that she'd be coming back. She was also changing colour. She'd been there for quite a while. It was pretty obvious that she wasn't going to be much.
Yeah.
She wasn't going to have a successful outcome. Anyway, so we go. It's amazing how there wasn't a lot of adrenaline, but there was certainly a sense of urgency.
Yep.
And you roll straight into that CPR. Now this is an AMBO's job 101. And look, all police will give CPR at one time. Just to put it out there, in my career, I performed CPR on 23 occasions.
Yeah.
And for anyone who may want to drop in front of me and require CPR, I'd advise strongly against it because I killed every single one of them.
You didn't have a very good success rate at all.
So I know there's other people, I've spoken to long-term people in the RFS down in New South Wales who've done CPR on one or two occasions and the people have lived.
Yeah.
Well, not me.
Yeah, don't call Damo.
23 and zero, which I'm not proud of, but I mean, it is what it is. It's obviously got more to do with the situation than it was with me.
Yeah.
So we work into the CPR, and you realise from a practical point of view how exhausting it is.
Mm.
Anybody who's done CPR, and most police, it would be unlikely that a police officer will get through a career of any length and not perform CPR at some point. The one thing that I got taught early on was ditch the ego. Go for 2 minutes, step out, step someone else in. I think ditch the ego is a really good...
To
talk about
because you're not
in
being
general.
A benefit to the person by being tired and
no, absolutely you know, not.
And it is a tiring process.
Yeah, and I was also aware that what we were doing for this person was not necessarily going to save her life, but I think what we worked out was I heard it from a more senior member, and this comes into a bit of the dark humour of policing. He said, and at no expense to anyone, it's like sometimes a bit of street theatre is good for the people who are watching.
Yep.
So for that truck driver who was very distressed, he'd called this job in.
Yep.
For him to be able to sit there and go, no, well, at least the police and the ambulance, they did everything they could possibly do for this person. I feel that I've done what I needed to do.
Yeah.
The Ambos, when they were there, basically said that she had been deceased for a lot longer than we'd been on scene. So, yep. Basically, it had died immediately in the crash. And yep. that's of assurance to us.
Definitely.
But I think the assurance to the truck driver was that we still gave it our best shot. And yep. I think he sort of, that was good for his mental health a little bit, that he'd done the right thing. He'd called AAA. We'd had a go, and through no fault of his own, that was the end of that. So I think the first thing that happened, talking about this is your first critical incident.
Yep.
The debrief that I really thought was excellent after that was, I had a really good shift sergeant at that point. He was a bit of a rogue, but that's what you want. And he called us over. He said, "Right, guys, end of the night, we're going to go over to the police club." And he says, "I don't care if you come over and have a cup of tea. I want you there for 5 minutes."
And I'm just going to break in there, mate. Mm. That is what we talk about, what the police club's about. And when I was shift sergeant, I'd say it was mandatory to come over to the police club. I don't care if you drink water.
Yeah.
But you will come there for at least half an hour to an hour to debrief.
And to wind it down. Oh, obviously, people had to pick up kids or do whatever. Yeah. They had something to do. It wasn't. It's not mandatory as such, but it was... The preference was certainly...
Oh, it was with me, mate.
Absolutely. You are a hard man, Chilton. So we returned, and I think when you're in the moment, and a lot of people may have similar experiences, where when you're in the moment of that initial role, there's no trauma. You're doing the job. It's you've actually got a lot of purpose.
Yep.
And for a little while, you almost feel euphoric. You've done this thing. The adrenaline's pumped. You've really... done what is a critical... You're a very important member of society when you're performing CPR on a person.
Yep.
So there's a lot of purpose involved in that. But what goes up must come down. And always within a few hours, I found that you would get that shakes. You'd get the... Almost a feeling of a bit... Almost a bit teary, some people.
Yeah.
I know that some people respond a bit like that. Others go a bit quiet.
Mm.
And it was so critical to go over to that club there. And that particular sergeant was really good at that. He pulled us over there... Sat us down, and he didn't say, "So how does everybody feel?" and try and make someone look like a victim in front of everyone else. He started talking about his experience through the day and how, gee, that was, we did our best there, but it wasn't good enough. Sometimes it you just can't save these people. But he said, and he offered pride. He said, "I'm really proud of how everyone worked. You junior guys have never seen things like this. That's quite traumatic. And don't worry, if you feel a bit upset about that, that's really normal." So for someone to have that conversation in 2008 was a little bit before its time. Really.
Yeah.
There was still an element of that tough.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And that's all well and good. Like, there's a time where police have to be tough.
You're tearing me up right now. And that is actually a cause of PTSD as well, because you actually relive, you can relate to it so closely.
Yep, absolutely. And then the beauty of that sort of thing is, and this is where I talk about alcohol as not being completely bad, that just a couple of beers can break the tension and get someone to talk who otherwise wouldn't speak. I'm not saying you go home and you sit in the corner and drink a bottle of scotch. But
well, that's the worst thing you can do.
The worst. If you're trying to medicate with it, that's bad.
Yeah.
If you're using it, and look, psychologists may disagree. And look, they're the ones who know what they're talking about, apparently, so that's the end of that.
Yep.
But I found personally, and I think the shared experience with us was, that people... who can gather around in and share that burden, share that exposure, and be sitting with the, not the people who tell you how you should think, but telling you that any response that you have is normal. That's a normal response. You've just dealt with a deceased person in front of other people. And quite often it's not the person who's deceased themselves. It's actually the bystanders and the responses, the emotional response from other people, people who are bystanders. And that's where the collective trauma for me sort of...
Yeah, definitely. Mate, I'm just going to add in there, there is one reason why I'm actually saying after the police force, and a lot of it is sitting down having a beer with you.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and we do talk about, and at times, and it's at no detriment to the person that's either deceased and all that, we will make a bit of a joke, but that's how we deal with it.
That's true, and look, we'll talk about it in other...
Close humour.
Yeah, it's right. It's that dark humour. And the fact of the matter is that there's got to be humour in the room.
Yeah, definitely.
Never at the expense of a victim.
No.
And it's not, I mean, that's not funny.
No.
What's happened there's not funny.
No.
The humour could be related to anything.
Exactly.
It could be something that someone said. It could be a reaction. Who knows what it is? It will happen spontaneously. But a good leader will grab that tension and turn it into humour.
Yep.
And I say it all the time. If you don't have a sense of humour, I don't want to know you.
No. Especially in the police, it's very important to actually be able to... I suppose it's a way of switching off to a certain extent. And you lighten the mood. And it also... Laughter's obviously a good, antidote for just about anything, especially depression and all that sort of stuff. And it does definitely lighten the room. It doesn't mean that you forget about it. It doesn't mean that you treat people badly. But it just means that you yourself can have a bit of a laugh about something. And it, like you said, could be something totally outside the stupid.
Yeah.
You know, it could be somebody tripping over a fence. But who knows? Just do it to kind of change the subject and let people feel at ease.
Absolutely. Critical. And I think that's the thing. I know that a lot of people listening will relate to that. They'll go that, it's always good to have that person who can break it.
Yep.
But I think that shared burden, that early in the piece also realising, hang on, I am still very junior. I'm still a junior copper. I don't know everything.
Yeah. You can't control the world.
Yeah, exactly.
That's probably one of the big things as police, I think. Mm. You go to an incident and you can't own it. You can't determine an outcome.
No. An excellent piece of information that I got sort of, I think someone said it without thinking it, but it stuck with me for a long time. And this was later on in my career, but it certainly relates back, and it would be good advice or a good thing for a junior police officer to grab onto. This is not my tragedy.
No.
This is a tragedy. Recognise it for what it is. But it's your job to attend and bring calm and restore order to the chaos.
Yep.
It's not your job to be emotionally involved in every single tragedy that occurs. If that's the way you carry on, and that doesn't necessarily mean you're a bad person. Probably means you're a very good person.
Yep.
But there's no longevity in that.
Right.
Because you are going to attend, in a long career, a lot of tragedy.
Yeah.
And you've got to recognise, this is not my tragedy. That may sound cold. It's not.
No.
This is not your tragedy.
That's how you survive.
That's exactly right. And to learn that early on, when you're starting to get pretty good at your job, it's almost like that next level. It's that next little tick off. Like you've achieved that now. So you've now been to that critical incident.
Yep.
You've dealt with that trauma. You've seen the senior guys dealing with
the
group. So you've seen your good
leaders. You feed
leaders.
Off that as well.
Absolutely. See your good leaders pulling in the crew and building that crew and making sure, normalising is the word, normalising that trauma.
Yes, exactly, yeah, that's a perfect...
Well, normalising the feeling of that trauma, the responses.
I'll touch on, and this is something, obviously, I'd been in the police a number of years, and, ex-wife now, but she joined the job, and I remember, she asked me one day, and she goes, she saw her first dead body, she goes, how do you deal with it? And it was a serious question. I said, look, you've just got to... I said, how I deal with it and how you deal with it might be different. I said, basically, I sit there and go, okay, I've done everything that I can possibly do. But I said, in the end, shit happens.
Yeah.
And I said, look, that's how I deal with it. I can't tell you how to deal with it. But, you've just got to have to figure that out on yourself. I'm there to listen. You want to talk? I'm great at that.
Yeah.
And I think actually as police officers, and one thing I've noticed, and I was going to bring this up earlier, and I actually forgot, but I've remembered now, is the fact that we're very good listeners.
Very good.
We spend a lot of time listening, and it comes from interviews, it comes from talking to other cops, because you like hearing what other people have to say. That's how you get your evidence.
Mm.
So it's not about being domineering and talking over people and all that sort of thing. It's about listening.
Mm. And the act of listening is such an important thing, and I can touch on that more when we talk about negotiations. And
definitely.
Like
well, you are the trained officer when it comes to negotiations.
Oh, that was, yeah, but that was, I think everyone's good at it.
I mean, you could take a candy off a baby without it crying.
Well, no, they generally cry, but I get the candy. But the, that ability to communicate with a human being was something that you learn very early on.
Definitely.
So, I think... If any, to take away from this particular one is that there's the stages of development as you go through, we're talking maybe 6 months in the job, six months through your probation, where you're actually in your mind, just to recap what we were speaking about, you feel like you're now a good member of the crew.
Yep.
But it's that first critical incident.
Yep.
That first major job where, it might even be a complex job where there's more than one involved.
Definitely.
It might be the first time you're exposed to specialist teams.
Yep.
I'll never forget the first time TRG were at a job that I was at. I felt, I think I was an outer cordon very, very outer person.
Oh, I think I remember that incident.
Yeah, so an outer cordon, so just for those who are playing along at home.
And TRG.
And TRG, so yeah. The Territory Response Group is the... Is the
they're the SAS of police.
Yeah, well, wow. I think the SAS might argue with that. the tactical... Once you've got a critical incident, you've got tactical police. So in the Northern Territory, it's the Territory Response Group. And a critical component of that's negotiators, which is what I've also done. But when you're first involved in that in as a junior police officer, it is something that is far and beyond what you'd previously dealt with. So it's all of a sudden, it's not just you and your partner and your sergeant. It's a much bigger... You're part of a much bigger thing. And you develop through that, you learn through that. And I think we're going to touch more on that as we go along. And what are your thoughts on that, Chiltsy? What are you on the first time exposed to specialists and more complex jobs?
I think, mate, what I reckon, Rashi, we're keeping these podcasts 25 minutes.
Yeah,
and we're basically at that now. I know. Look, we will have the occasion where we do the longer one, but I've got. Yeah, like you've actually explained your incident, and I think mine might take a little while and probably a bit of feedback from yourself as well. So what we might actually do is actually save that one for the next one, because I remember sitting down with you and having a drink about that incident.
Yeah,
clearly, and that was definitely one of the first big incidents that you attended, and it actually hit even the whole community as Catherine pretty hard as well. It was definitely, and it was something that made the job real as well.
Absolutely.
I think. And especially when, you know, somebody, the people knew and you can relate to that. You know, if you're dealing with someone you don't know, it's definitely a lot easier. So, but so what we might actually do is finish it up.
No, we can wrap it up. Absolutely. Yep. So look, we've spoken about that next step. So moving from being the bright new shiny star to all of a sudden you're in the job and you're starting to go to your first major incidents, and we're at that point. So we're going to progress through and start to talk about the development into a more senior member and discuss a few of those critical things that happened early on that we still remember.
Yep.
And go from there.
Yep.
Wrap it up, Chiltsy.
We'll see you next time, mate.
Absolutely.
And I'll be talking about my first big incident.
Always a pleasure.
All right.